Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Thursday. It's May 28th. On the phone with us now from the ABC Forecast Center, Erica Martin. Good morning.
Good morning. We are tracking a warm-up in the works. So we're going to see mid-70s for today. I'm back to 74, just below mid-70s. 74 is your expected high temperature. Tonight, you're going to have overnight lows in the mid-50s. Tomorrow, we're tracking slightly warmer temperatures. It looks like you'll hit 77 degrees. And I am tracking increasing clouds. Now, this is just very typical this time of anytime you get that really strong daytime heating. You get those diurnal showers. I just expect one or two isolated thunderstorms. That's just about it. Otherwise, it's going to be a mainly dry day. So I'd like to emphasize that. It's a fair weather day. It's going to be very nice, very warm, but you will get those pop-up showers later in the day on Friday. And on Saturday, we're going to see temperatures climb close to 80. I might leave us at 80 degrees. I'm not seeing much of a northerly influence at all. I'm seeing a southerly influence there. So overnight, though, we could see some scattered showers, lows in the low 50s. And then on Sunday, we start to dip just a little bit more. 73 degrees is your expected high temperature. On Monday, we're going to be right around the same temperature mark, 73 to 74 degrees. But what we're watching right now is a storm that will follow our high pressure ridge that we have in place right now that's keeping these conditions so warm. It'll get here by Tuesday, possibly late Monday to Tuesday, Wednesday. It'll bring in some showers, cooler temperatures, and some isolated thunderstorms, which could really help us with this drought monitor that we have that really hasn't been dented at all. I mean, we haven't done anything to it. It's just been very dry since the top of the year. So that's pretty much our story. But just, guys, still be mindful. Even though you're seeing mid to upper 70s for the next couple of days, don't take that for granted. Make sure you stay hydrated. And if you are traveling, especially to Utah-Dixie, be aware that you're going to encounter triple digits when you head there.
Okay. Hey, thanks, Erica.
Thanks, Leslie.
KPCW News Time now, 8:08. We'll stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Snyderville Basin Planning Commission Chair Ryan Dickey with an update on Tuesday's meeting, which heard from neighbors about the Colby School bed and breakfast proposal. Park City Museum historian Sandy Brumley will be on the phone along with the great-grandson of Thomas Kern, Michael Kearns, talking about the history lecture that was held earlier this week. And finally, I'll be talking with the executive director of the Mountain Valley chapter of the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, Mike Summers, along with volunteer and local resident Christina Miller. They've got details on this year's virtual Hope Gala to benefit the JDRF. Stay tuned. And stay tuned. Coming up on Cool Science Radio right after the local news hour, today's guests include Dr. Nicola Fox, the Heliophysics Division Director for NASA headquarters there in Washington, D.C. Heliophysics is the science of the sun, which studies the physical connections between the sun and our solar system. Then Matthew Cobb, author of the book The Idea of the Brain, The Past and Future of Neuroscience. He talks about the history of brain science, but more importantly, what current research on the human brain is telling us. Again, all of that coming up on today's edition of Cool Science Radio at 9:06. Well, we're winding down the last few days of May, which has been designated as National Mental Health Awareness Month. KPCW's Rick Bruff reports that beyond May, there are still some online support groups available for those who are coping with some mental challenges.
KPCW talked to Owen Ashton, who is the board president for the National Association of Mental Illness, or NAMI, a group that offers help both for those personally struggling with mental illness and for family members or caregivers of victims. During May, NAMI offered free online support groups. Ashton said those will be ongoing. He said he had his own struggles dealing with depression and anxiety.
Earlier in my life, I had some major depressive episodes, I think they're called, that landed me in a psychiatric ward. Most of my life, I've been fairly functional, but just have bad days now and then. But I, for years, kind of lived without knowing that I had a condition, chronic depression and so forth. And then my wife, after we've been married about 12 years, kind of leaned on me and said, Owen, you're a workaholic and you're aloof from the family when you're home with us. So you need to get help. And I didn't see any need to, but she was very insistent, so I did. And it turned out to be just a fabulous experience of getting to know myself and really getting to a better place in my life.
He said treatment can be a big help for the self-styled macho man who thinks that he has to tough it out with problems he encounters at work or at home. He talked about how support groups and other treatment helped him.
I had talk therapy with clinicians, with therapists for years, and that was really helpful in helping me to understand some difficult challenges that I had during my teen years, some trauma and so forth. So they really helped me get through that, but then going to the support groups has helped me to get rid of some of the, I call it self-stigma and shame, just realizing that there are a lot of other people that are in similar situations. So that's really been helpful. And then also, we get to share coping mechanisms. Like I remember in one session, one of the individuals there was talking about how important sleep was to them. And I had never really thought about that.
Ashton said each online group has about 10 to 15 people. In some ways, they can be better than an in-person meeting since participants don't have to travel. Ashton said he trains the facilitators for the support groups, who are all volunteers, not professionals.
We're dealing with what can be very sensitive things, so training is very important, and so we go through like a two or three day courses. Every person that facilitates one of these groups, and we always have two facilitators at least, and every one of them has gone through a fairly rigorous training course to just know how to manage the class and keep it headed in the right direction.
Owen Ashton from the National Association of Mental Illness. For more information, you can go online to NAMI, N-A-M-I, UT.org. For KPCW, I'm Rick Broth.
It's 8:14. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, as we've reported, the Centerville Basin Planning Commission held a public hearing Tuesday on the proposed plans for the Coley Bread and Breakfast application. On the phone with a recap of that meeting, I have the chair of the Planning Commission, Ryan Dickey. Good morning to you, Ryan.
Hey, good morning, Leslie. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about yourself. You've taken over from former Chair Melina Stevens here.
Yes, and Melina did a great job, and so I'm the new chair. I'm a real estate agent in town. I also own a small business, Model HOA, with my wife. We manage a bunch of HOAs in town, and happy to serve.
Okay, so talk just, if you would, for a second about how you think the electronic meeting system is working. Do you feel like that the public is getting an opportunity to participate, to find out what's going on by being able to see any presentations that are made and to be able to make comments?
You know, I think it's going pretty well. I mean, fits and starts, of course. I don't think I knew what Zoom was 2.5 months ago, and now we live by it. But there are pluses and minuses. You know, one tweak we've made is, you know, we started out with taking questions on chat, and now we've said, you know, we want to make sure people can have their face on camera if necessary, and really try to make this as close to what we would do in person as possible. So I think it's gone pretty well. There are some advantages. I mean, I think in some sense there, and I hope the public will continue to get in on this. You don't have to drive down to the Riches Building to make public comment now. You can log in on your computer, and contrary to what you might think, we are desperate for public input all the time. We have so many topics where we have almost no public input that actually end up being pretty important. So there's pluses and minuses, but so far so good.
Okay. Well, back to the agenda then, and to the Colby School Bread and Breakfast application. Let's talk about how we solve the owner-occupied issue. That seemed to be the catching point there. It's legally necessary to establish the Colby as a bread and a bed and breakfast rather than a small hotel, but the owner isn't an individual, but rather a corporate entity. So how do we move forward here?
That's right. And that's, before we even get to, sort of your typical conditions around things like noise and lighting, that's been this threshold question for the commission. And it's really important because, you can have an 8-room bed and breakfast and an 8-room small hotel. Bed and breakfast is the only lodging that's allowed in our residential zones. And really the principal difference between a bed and breakfast and a small hotel is that a bed and breakfast is owner occupied. And that's important. And it's there for a reason in the code, which is that we think that the fact that an owner of that property running the bed and breakfast is in the neighborhood, knows the neighborhood, walks the dog, has a vested interest in the property values of the neighborhood, that in itself is a really important mitigation for allowing lodging in a residential zone. So when the application describes, that a caretaker, probably a paid caretaker, would be the owner-occupant and conceivably would have some ownership interest in the corporation, that clears the hurdle of owner-occupancy. And I think that's something that we've just been digging in on and really trying to unpack whether that meets the bar.
Yeah. So out of the various ideas from the planning commissioners, any one in particular that you favor? One commissioner said that before a business license is granted, the applicants have to show that the occupant has a deeded ownership interest in the property. Others said they want the occupant to be identified. Others said they just need more information.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no, I don't think there's any clear direction from the commission at that point, at this point. And I think it's okay. I think that's our job to dig in and figure this out. I think you go all the way from, you can ask yourself the question of, can a corporation even be, does that even meet the spirit of owner-occupied? I think, there are complex questions about corporate personhood there. I think we know that a corporate structure can exist in a bed and breakfast. So you have sort of the spectrum of they need to have something that perhaps they need a controlling interest in the corporation, all the way down to if they have a strict definition of owner. If they have 1/1000th of the corporation, they're an owner and they're an owner occupant. The challenge here is I think we don't have information from the applicant yet about who that caretaker, who the owner occupant would be. And so we can either send that to, we can approve the CUP and handle that through the business license process. We could condition it in a certain way, sort of without knowing who the owner-occupant is. Here's the conditions an owner-occupant has to meet when they go through business licensing. Those are the type of things we're working through, and we'll get there, but we're not there yet.
Okay. And let's talk, and I know another concern is special events. What controls can the Planning Commission place on the events that would be held here?
Well, I think, and we've only dug into this a little bit, but I think we have a special event process through in our code already. So such that outdoor events are obviously the concern of the neighbors, and rightfully so. Those create those create problems around lighting, noise, et cetera. Already in the code, any outdoor or temporary events that don't normally occur with the permitted use have to go through the special event permit process. And so I think we'll probably sort of lean on that special event permit process to handle events, but probably something we'll work through is just making sure that we're clear on what is an event that doesn't normally occur with a permitted use, such that a bed and breakfast, we see, we've all probably been to or driven by a bed and breakfast with a wedding going on, probably dialing in a little bit about whether that's normal course of business or if that's a special event.
Well, outside of the pandemic, though, I mean, would any special event have a limit on the number that could be held there at the Colby School?
I don't know that we would have a specific number tied to special events, but I think that's probably something that the commission could choose to condition or not. We haven't gotten into that in detail, so we're not really there yet.
Okay. So does that need to be taken care of, though, or is that the B&B can go forward and any special events then would just be handled by the special event processing then?
Well, I think it could go either way, and so I think it should be addressed. Obviously, that's a point of public, that was part of the public comment. We want to make sure we're thinking about it, but I don't think we've determined whether anything needs to be conditioned on top of what we already have around special events yet.
Okay, and then also the commission looking at the amendment for the colony. We're talking about adding over 100,000 square feet of some non-residential density and uses there.
Yes. Yeah, so the this was a work session, so we don't actually have an application from us, but work sessions, they come to us and sort of looking for some feedback from the commission as they work on an application. The issue at the colony, they are looking for density for a couple things, up to 135,000 square feet. For one, they have the colony maintains private roads and bridges and snow removal and salt. These are things they used to handle with outside vendors who drive into the colony. They've over time brought a lot of that in-house and are looking for more facilities for the HOA. So for the things I described, expanding the mail house, they get, 20 times as many packages as they ever envision, like we all do. The second part of the density is looking for density for amenities. So things like a clubhouse, swimming pool, tennis courts, a private restaurant. And so there's a density piece, and then there's the use piece of whether the uses that this new density would allow, whether those are actually allowed under the Canyon Spa.
Okay, so at this point, we've of course have the provision 2.3, which basically says no new density without compelling public benefit. Since this is all a private operation, there really is no public benefit except for the residents themselves.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a challenge for the application, and that's a challenge for any application that comes to us for additional density. To approve any density in the Snyderville Basin until existing density rights are exhausted, there has to be a countervailing public interest that's met. And that's probably even a higher standard than just simply a public benefit that we used to have in our code and use in the spa. They can't simply deliver tennis courts for the public. We're talking about a significant interest to the public. Typically, I think affordable housing has been the only thing that's come through us so far that we have said meets that bar. So but probably two challenges for the applicant. One, you open up a 1998 development agreement, or perhaps this portion has been updated since then. But an older development agreement, you're now subject to today's requirements around affordable housing, just at a minimum, whether that's delivering a percentage of the density as affordable housing or paying it in lieu of fee. But second, any new density is going to have to meet that countervailing public interest bar, which is a legislative act and a pretty high hurdle. So I don't think I don't mean to sound negative about it, because I think the uses are generally the uses are appropriate in the colony. There wasn't any objection to that. This is just sort of a hurdle in our code that as we talk through the application with the applicant, we just made sure they were understanding sort of what happens when you open up that development agreement.
Right. And these amenities, where are they proposed to go? The clubhouse, the pool, the tennis courts?
Well, we didn't go through each parcel, but the HOA does have parcels with some existing HOA facilities. They talked about, potentially the colony yurt that you see if you're out skiing at the canyons, that could become a private restaurant. But they're within the colony development within their parcels.
Okay. So at this point, you're not saying the request is DOA at this point? I mean, do you think that there could be amendments made or agreements made that could make it happen?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we don't have an application from us, so I would never say an application is DOA. And I think that the colony has even in the, it's really just sort of a letter at this point, the information we got, they talked about delivering some affordable housing. Certainly as a member of the community, you love the idea that we're taking commercial traffic off of Highway 224. And if the colony is, managing things like snow removal from within their development without traffic, I mean, there's some good things in the application that we think we'll see in an application. So it's not DOA at all. We love applications that come to us and deliver all kinds of things that serve the public interest and give us affordable housing. So it's really just a conversation about the application, and I don't mean to imply that it's DOA at all.
Okay. Brian, anything else you wanted to mention?
I don't think so. Those were the two big ones. I think things are going well on Zoom. I think the public's having input, and so far so good. I hope we can get to a place where we're in person and seeing everybody in person as soon as we can.
Okay. Hey, Ryan, thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, Leslie.
Ryan Dickey is the chairman of the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW Newstime 827. Well, despite a shortened school year, the Youth Sports Alliance continued to impact young athletes pursuing their goals as nearly 50 youth athletes were named to national teams. KPCW's David Boyle has that update.
Well, the Youth Sports Alliance hopes come wintertime that the area will be in the green phase of COVID-19. The group is preparing contingency plans to provide services regardless. Director Emily Fisher gave some examples of what their programs could look like in the green or yellow phases.
For instance, under yellow, cross-country skiing classes could be conducted at the school site. We have been working with all of our great partners to see how we can get equipment and venues and coaches to where the students are. So those would potentially happen at the school sites. We are so lucky in Park City that we have trails and grooming that are so close to many of our different schools. If we were under green, cross-country classes would include transportation to and from White Pine Touring.
Fisher says they, like most nonprofits in the area, are working on how to raise funds for their programming, although they are not sure exactly what they will look like this year. Fisher says their programming continues to be a success with 1,700 students participating in after-school programs during the shortened school year. She also shared that they saw 44 current or alumni athletes named to the national and junior national teams.
14 of those athletes participated in our Get Out and Play program, and 2 of those athletes participated in our Activate After School program, which just started in 2016 and is geared towards middle school and junior high students. So exciting just to see all of the local athletes who are having success at that national and international level. 7 of the nominees received direct training funds from our Stein Erickson Opportunity Fund, and then 11 of those athletes are brand new to the national team. So really fun to celebrate some of those local success stories.
The list of those athletes can be found on YSA's website. Additional accolades have been given by the U.S. Ski and Snowboard National Organization. They named Wasatch Freestyle the Freestyle Club of the Year. I'm David Boyle, KPCW News.
Well, the Park City Council is hosting a special meeting today at 4:30. You can go to parkcity.org to find out how to listen in or give public comment. The council will be adopting a resolution acknowledging Linda Perkins' retirement from the Park City Cooperative Preschool. They'll then be holding a public hearing and will be considering approval for a Level 4 special event permit for the Downtown Business Improvement District, including car-free use of Main Street on Sundays. The proposal for a car-free Main Street will run from June 14th to September 15th from 11 a.m. to 10 p.m. Well, 3 major universities in Utah have announced that students will return to campus this fall for in-person classes with preventative measures to curtail the spread of the coronavirus. The Salt Lake Tribune reporting that announcements from the University of Utah, Southern Utah University, and Utah State University included measures such as smaller class sizes and keeping some larger classes online. The Utah Board of Higher Education is expected to release a draft of specific criteria this week from colleges choosing to reopen. Fall classes at the 3 universities are scheduled to begin in August, but continue to be contingent on the number of cases statewide. Well, the CEO of the company set to build the Mayflower Mountain Resort updated the MIDA board on their progress at a meeting on Tuesday. KPCW's David Boyle has that story.
Extel CEO Gary Barnett reported to the Military Installation Development Authority Board about the progress of the Mayflower Mountain Resort set to be built on the east side of US 40 near the Jordanelle Reservoir. Barnett says they were close to finalizing financing for the construction of the military hotel in the Mayflower area when they were derailed by COVID-19. He says now they're feeling ready to move forward.
We're cautiously looking, trying to figure out how we can get started again towards moving on the MWR hotel. We had accomplished a great deal construction-wise on the site, 90% of the way getting done the VCP remediation. We are actually going to be planting there now to make sure that we don't lose any of that benefit and don't cause any erosion or dust.
Barnett says they've also completed some road work, retaining walls, and the 1.2 million gallon water tank. He says that's all leading up to the build-out of the military hotel, which will include 100 dedicated rooms available at a reduced rate for military members, as well as dedicated meeting space. Barnett also updated the board on the long long-term lease Extell agreed to with Deer Valley Resort.
A long-term lease with Deer Valley Resort for portions of the land that were owned by us and that they were skiing on, as well as some additional land. Part of this master plan for the area, our goal is to turn it into a really spectacular additional resort on this side of the mountain with the direct access, you know, cutting down on traffic and also, of course, increasing the amount of jobs and the amount of economic activity. We think that this could be the finest resort perhaps in North America, certainly one of the finest in the world. Our most preferred route for moving forward is to connect this to Deer Valley, have this as one integrated resort with the folks from Deer Valley. And we are certainly going to include them in discussions as we finish planning this and move down the road. But of course, it also has the ability to stand on its own as a world-class ski and ski out village and resort.
Utah Senate President Stuart Adams sits on the MIDA board. He remained hopeful that the Mayflower Mountain Resort project will be able to secure financing at a good rate.
The positive side of, I suppose, of the virus, if there is a positive side, is that interest rates have remained relatively low. There's somewhat of an additional scrutiny on underwriting, but the rates are there. And so hopefully the projects, especially some of those on the east side that are in place, will have financial validity with low interest rates. So we'll see what happens as far as tax increment and how we do.
Adams adds, while interest rates are good, they are trending up. Members of the board and Barnett agreed to work to June 15 as a date to have details in their agreement worked out so that Extell can secure their financing. I'm David Boyle, KPCW News.
News time now, 8:35. Well, in 1883, at just the age of 21, Thomas Kearns moved to Park City, where he worked in mining. He prospected and operated several mines. 6 years later, he and his partner, David Keith, discovered the silver that became the famous Silver King Coalition Mine. Kearns went on to serve as a Park City Council member, a Utah senator, and owner of the Salt Lake Tribune before dying at a young age in 1918. The Park City Museum hosted a virtual lecture about Thomas Kearns this week, featuring his great-grandson, Michael Kearns, and moderated by historian Sandy Broomley. Both of them join me now on the phone. Good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
Hey,
good morning, Leslie.
Sandy, do you want to start and just talk a little bit about the gathering that you did here on Zoom? Did you get a good turnout of history buffs?
Yeah, we did. I think we had about 65 people that showed up, and they were from a mix of locations. There were a lot of Parkites on the line, but we had people spanning from Nantucket to Spokane, Washington.
Wow. So tell us why you wanted to focus on Thomas Kearns.
Well, I moved to town about 3 years ago and became fascinated with the history. And as I looked more closely at the characters that inhabited this town during that time, it was clear Thomas Kearns really popped to the top as being, you know, the single most interesting character. I mean, the rags to riches story is very compelling, but also what we shared in our session yesterday was he was really a man of the Wild West, right? He grew up in O'Neill, Nebraska. He visited Deadwood, you know, about 3 years after Wild Bill Hickok was there. When he left O'Neill, he went to Tombstone, Arizona, right at the time of the gunfight at the OK Corral. And then he came to Park City and made himself a rich man. So what an amazing story, right?
Yeah, yeah. And certainly as I ran down that introduction, there are lots of accomplishments and successes. Talk a little bit about just his political career. Again, a Park City Council member, then going on to be a Utah senator.
Right, right. Well, he, you know, was always a mover and shaker. You know, that's how he kind of made his impact in the mines. He quickly kind of gravitated to doing that in the town. The first town office he held was constable. That was a little bit of a family business. His half-brother Barney was a sheriff back in O'Neill. You know, from there he went to alderman, and, you know, he did have an unsuccessful run as a state senator against R.C. Chambers, who was the guy who operated the Ontario mine. Politics is a mix of success and failure and success again. He finally ended up as a U.S. senator from 1901 to 1905.
Yeah. And Michael, I think it's fourth grade when we learn about our state history. Did you grow up in Utah, so you would be familiar with Utah history?
Well, I was born here, and then I grew up in California in a little town called Atherton.
Okay, so it wasn't like you could, you know, in fourth grade could have said, hey, dude, you know, y'all, this is my great-grandpa, huh?
Well, you know, certain things are always kind of passed down to you through the family and such, but I wasn't in a class learning about it. My classroom really was my home and family talking about these things. But, yeah, not that much.
Yeah. So what did you know about Thomas Kern as you were growing up?
Well, I knew he was a politician in Utah, and as I got older, I probably didn't really understand who he was until I was about 17 or 18. And then it started kicking in as I started being more aware of politics.
Okay. So you weren't, again, didn't grow up here in Utah and didn't, like, get to drive by what, you know, his former home, you know, which is now the Kern's Mansion, also known as the Governor's Mansion, huh?
Yes. Yes. It wasn't like that, except that I'd occasionally come in for certain things. My father died when I was about 11, so before that, we used to drive from California up to a place in Montana, and then we'd always stop by and see cousins and such around here, and that's kind of how I got exposed to it.
Okay. And you know, now that you've got the wisdom of age, what do you think his greatest legacy was?
I think his greatest legacy was for the common man. He was a hard rock miner, and he never forgot his friends or never forgot to benefit for them. In the Utah constitutional times, when they were trying to make Utah state, if you read the detailed account of that, you know, one of the big things he did was making sure that the miners had an 8-hour day instead of working 12 or 13 hours a day. The Constitution.
Okay, you're cutting out a little bit there. Hey, Sandy, can you tell us any more, another story or two about things we might not know about Thomas Kearns? Of course, you know, as a founder of the famous Silver Cream Coalition Mine, that's kind of right there at the top of the list, I'm guessing.
Well, yeah, it is, and there are many colorful stories about how that mine came to be, right? I mean, you know, his initial work was with a smaller mine called the Woodside that was owned by town founder Ed Ferry. He basically, you know, had a contract to dig a tunnel for them. He went in and really discovered the direction that the ore was headed in the ground, you know, to follow the vein. That went into some contiguous property called the Mayflower. And that's when he formed the Mayflower Group with four other, you know, founding citizens of Park City. And, you know, from there, it really blossomed as they followed that vein and went on up the hill to, you know, to create the Silver King Mine that you see today. When...
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I lose you there?
No, I'm here.
We might have lost. You know, it's a remarkable story. Kern was born in 1862. I think about 3 days after, 3 days after. And Grant,
hello.
Big victory there. So that's kind of the beginnings of him in Ontario, Canada. He came out here to O'Neill, which was kind of a town built by the Irish for the Irish in a time when no Irish need apply. But O'Neill was a very colorful character. He has the distinction of actually attacking the British in Canada
and beating them Ridgeway. It was a victory, but he was part of the group, and a lot of those people in O'Neill, Nebraska were all Fenians as well. So that, I don't think that ever left Tom.
Okay, I'm having some phone problems here, but I wanted to just bring this up, the fact that he died so young. That was in October of 1918. This actually was the kind of the second wave there of the Spanish flu, but that's not what killed him, huh?
No, he was young. He was 56, and he was struck by a car as he got off a streetcar. He was heading to his office on South Temple in Maine. And by his own accounts, he tried to dodge this car, and the car went after him. He tried to dodge it again, and the car hit him, and it broke his leg, which probably led to complications. He had a stroke, and I don't know why, but they walked him down to his office down at the Kearns Building, and instead of his home, which was about equal distance. But anyway, 10 days later, he died, and who knows if Spanish flu had anything to do with it. His longtime partner, David Keith, had just died a few months before at the Hotel Utah, which was known as the Hotel Utah at the time, and that was 1918, and that was when the Spanish flu was really coming into its peak around Salt Lake.
Yeah. So was the car accident? Was it investigated as a homicide of the guy was running a bill?
I'm still looking at that. I got the records from back then, in October 1918. So it's we're just not sure anymore. It was, a young Mormon kid. He was about 18 or 19. And it was
reportedly in the presence of one of the town constables, right? He was right there on the curb who saw it. So I think it was kind of an open and shut case from the police perspective.
It's car accidents aren't what they are today, and for lack of a better word, the traffic, and especially right there at South Temple in Maine, was a little bit helter-skelter, there's people running around and such, so.
Okay. Well, some fascinating history lessons. Again, what a great turnout, and I guess these are just open to anybody, if they're interested. Just follow the parkcityhistory.org.
That's right. They put those up on the website. Of course, they also send emails to members, and we did record our session, so if any of the listeners want to go back and listen to the recording, that should be up on the website later today.
Okay. I've got to leave it at there, guys, but Michael Kearns and Sandy Broomley, thanks very much for spending some time with us this morning.
Okay, Leslie. Thank you so much.
KPCW News Time now, 8:46. It's the local news hour here on KPCW. KPCW News Time now, 8:47. Good morning. Well, contractors for the Mayflower Mountain Resort project are back to work, and a review committee for MIDA is close to approving language around a conceptual and final subdivision plat. KPCW's David Boyle has more about that.
At the Military Installation Development Authority's May Development Review Committee meeting, the committee heard another update from Extel. VP Kirk Krieg reported that contractors are on site at the Mayflower Mountain Resort project, with their top priorities including filling the 1.2 million gallon water tank, as well as revegetating 90 acres of land. Krieg explains once the state issued the yellow order, they allowed contractors to return to the site.
So slowly we're rebuilding. I will say that we're monitoring on a daily and weekly basis to make sure for the new normal that we are protecting not only our consultants and contractors, but also our staff, as health is very, very important.
Krieg says they also expect an update from CEO Gary Barnett on the construction loan for the military hotel.
Most of our capital in the United States is tied up from a lending standpoint. We do need a construction loan for the MWR. We are talking to two different banks. We'll continue to shake that tree and get going when the lending frees up.
At the meeting, the committee discussed approving the conceptual and final plat subdivision language. Several versions were brought to the committee and included notes from the Midas staff, Extel, as well as Wasatch County Planner Doug Smith. Members of the committee had some disagreements on whether the conceptual and final subdivision plat language should be more of an overview or dive more into details. After discussion, the committee voted to add more time to review proposed changes and tabled the item to their meeting on June 16. I'm David Boyle, KPCW News.
Well, JRDF, that's the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, is the leading global organization that funds type 1 diabetes research. Just like many other nonprofit organizations, which rely on fundraising galas to continue their work, JRDF spring gala plans were also canceled. But organizers have come up with plans for something else. On the phone with details, I have the executive director of the Mountain Valley chapter of JDRF, Mike Summers, along with a local volunteer and Park City resident Christina Miller. Good morning to both of you.
Morning.
Good morning.
Mike, do you want to start and tell us what you've got planning? Usually you have a huge several hundred person gala at Little America.
Yeah, we're usually at the Grand America for our gala. We usually have about 500 guests, and it's a tremendous night of fundraising and celebration to talk about our message and our mission. And Christina's been a big part of that over the years. And unfortunately, we cannot be together like all of us know. So we are going to be able to host this live on KUTV on this Saturday between 6 and 7 p.m.
Okay, so tell me what's going to happen.
So we're going to embrace the telethon type of atmosphere that we had in the past. You'll be able to bid on auction items, and you're able to call in or simply text JDRF 2020 to 243-725, and you will be able to bid on auction items and make any gifts that you want. And then you can tune in to KUTV Channel 2 between 6 and 7, or you can get on KUTV.com or stream it live from our JDRF Mountain Valley Facebook page, and you can make a gift there.
Okay, so did KUTV, they came on as a sponsor then in order to do this, so you didn't have to actually pay for airtime, or?
Yes, they've been a very gracious host of ours. They came in at the 11th hour, said we would love to help you accomplish your goals, and they've been a part of our gala in the past, so we got with them, and we're working with their sports team, actually, so we're excited to have their sports team as our host. And they're going to let us take over their news program normally between 6 and 7 on Saturday. So we're very excited. This is a very unique opportunity, the opportunity to share our story and to talk about type 1 diabetes and our mission to cure that disease, as well as try to raise as much money as we can. Our auction opens actually today in a few hours. So if you text JDRF 2020 to 243-725, you can actually get registered, and that auction will be ready to go, and you start bidding on auction items as early as today.
Yeah, so Christina, I mean, this is something that you've helped organize in the past, and I mean, it was kind of like you had done it a few years, and you kind of know what to do and how to do it. This, we're talking about now becoming a TV producer, right? And it's live TV, so how have you guys figured that out?
Well, it's been interesting, just like with the rest of the world, we've had to switch gears and not all be present at the same place, and particularly because of the diabetes factor makes it an even more risky situation to get all of these kids and all these adults together. So luckily we have KUTV and this year's honorees, which are the University of Utah researchers who research a cure and treatment for diabetes, and JDRF supports them financially in that research, as well as researchers around the country. But yes, it's been interesting doing pre-interviews for the gala, trying to still socially distance for those pre-interviews, and then appear at the gala on a live broadcast as well. So one of the things you get to see is you will get much more screen time with the people who are actually affected with type 1 diabetes. So interviews with kids and adults, myself and my kids included, and you'll get to not only hear their story, but see them. And so while we can't all be together in the same room, I actually think that more people can participate in this type of format, not just from a financial perspective, but from a viewer perspective, and really get an understanding of what JDRF does and how it affects people with how type 1 diabetes is being affected by JDRF in a positive way.
Yeah. And that's, I guess many of us think, I mean, the fact that it's called juvenile diabetes, we think of it as a childhood disease, but I believe in your case, Christina, that was not the case. It turned up later in life.
Right. So I was diagnosed at 38. And actually, the numbers of adults who contract type 1 diabetes, which is an autoimmune disease, similar to lupus and rheumatoid arthritis and MS, many, many adults get it. So JDRF really is there to support everyone with type 1 diabetes. It's no longer just referred to as a something that a juvenile gets or a kid gets. Many, many people in their adults get it. And since type 1 diabetes is growing at an exponential rate, organizations like JDRF are incredibly important to try and find a cure or at least help fund research to make our lives a bit easier so we're not drying up insulin in a shot and giving ourselves shots all the time. Now we have, because of JDRF and its participation with research, now we have diabetes monitors and glucose monitors and insulin pumps, which makes it much easier.
Yeah. Well, can you talk a little about the latest, you or Mike, about the latest in T1D research? I mean, do we know more than we did a year ago?
Yes, the last 5 years has really been a windfall for diabetes research, especially in the part of treating. Our mission is to cure, treat, and prevent type 1 diabetes. So big windfalls in the treatment side. Now there are insulin pumps and glucose monitors that can speak to each other, and they can read and react to blood sugar. So for people living with type 1, they are able to monitor their blood sugar every few minutes and can see what their blood sugar numbers are and can make decisions based on trends and can try to get ahead of any highs and lows to keep you in a better range. And time and range is very critical when you're dealing with type 1 diabetes in order to avoid complications. And then the prevention side has been tremendous. We're now able to predict when someone will eventually have type 1 diabetes, and you can get ahead of it and seek out treatments. And we've been able to get FDA approval on repurposement of medications in order to help stave off that initial diagnosis of insulin dependence.
And have we figured out how to make insulin available to those who need it at a cost they can afford? That's been in the news.
We've been very fortunate that Utah has passed some laws to put a cap on insulin. JDRF has been a nationwide leader and advocate. In fact, Christina's family actually went back and spoke to our lawmakers in Washington, D.C. to try and not only lower the costs of insulin, but to stop the whole process of how the insurance companies and the pharmacy benefit managers and the insulin manufacturers work in our whole system, to change the system to where it can be a competitive side of things, so we can actually have some choice in that. And then it does JDRF and organizations like ours that come up with research technologies, if they're not FDA approved. So we need to have choice in that. So we work with the lawmakers, insurance companies, and everyone in that chain to make sure that people living with this disease can have the latest technologies and can try to afford them. And that's been a big battle. And we're very fortunate in Utah to have some of that. Not only it's a very strong bill to where it's capping insulin at a certain rate, but it also is allowing people that do not have insurance to be able to take advantage of lowering insulin costs, because insulin is too expensive at this point.
Okay. Again, people can just really, I mean, that's how they participate, is by tuning in to KUTV.com or just watching live on television Saturday at 6 to 7?
Absolutely. And like I said, you could text right now, JDRF2020 at 243-725. You can get registered. You'll receive a text the minute our auction goes live, and you can make a gift at that time. And you can also start looking. We have about 130 packages that will be up to start making bids on. And then we will close that auction at 8 o'clock on Saturday night. And then please tune in. We'd love to have you watch KUTV.com, KUTV Channel 2 on your TV station. And then you can also stream it live on our Facebook page, JDRF Mountain Valley Chapter Facebook.
Okay. Hey, Mike Summers, Christina Miller, thanks so much for your time and good luck with the fundraiser.
Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie.
You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. It's 9 o'clock. Up to 57 degrees here at 9 o'clock. Looking for a high today of about 78. Under mostly sunny skies, 48 under clear skies tonight. Tomorrow, a little bit warmer, 81 under mostly sunny skies, 83 on Saturday, back down to 80 on Sunday, and a very slight chance of an afternoon thunderstorm tomorrow afternoon. Looks like we have a better chance of some rain next week. This is KPCW Park City, time for news.